expressed in this podcast are those of the individual and not of their employer.
Hi, and welcome to Happen Happen Podcast 103. Hi, I'm Al.
I'm Stim.
And I'm Jerry.
How is everyone doing? It seems to be a month of outages this month, hasn't it? With a couple of with a fat finger with Azure, Amazon DNS issue, and the two outages on Azure front door. Quite interesting. Interesting. Did you know that they kind of do a with the Azure stuff? They do a post incident report, a report on YouTube, so you can go watch it, and they go quite detailed into it. It's interesting, the latest front door, they said it's a customer initiated issue which took out the whole front door. We had it where it looked like it, they released a new version of the API, and someone put it was looking for an array, but someone put a blank array or blank variable, and it basically caused something to go swift. So interesting. What about yourself, Jerry? How's it going with yourself?
Not too bad. Just listening to that wonderful Hybrid Cloud Show podcast. We were talking before the show about the fact it was also an empty DNS record, or they were talking about that, that cascaded into the AWS outage. So it seems like these cloud providers need to have some more validation on their inputs, maybe.
Yeah, who needs it, eh? The one thing that's interesting that when you were talking about the as you were having the post incident reviews on YouTube, I remember quite a few years ago GitLab had a massive one, and they did the entire incident on YouTube, and watching them fix it was fantastic. It just almost gave me more confidence in the product for an outage than any product marketing could ever do. So yeah, like when companies do
it. Also, the term came out of that hug ops.
So yes.
It's just, if you're working on a really tough problem which has brought the whole product down, then people need to show you some love while you're trying to fix it.
So. Yes, there's definitely enough channels out there for that, and enough Slack channels of that. So yeah.
But yeah, so you asked about my new gig, Al. Well, being a contractor, I've jump around quite a lot. I've happened to start working for this company that. They're migrating a lot of old software, old infrastructure, if you like, to more modern stuff. Accomplishing the same task, but in a more modern environment. So, at the moment, they've got an on-prem server which is running a few different things, not virtualized or anything, and it's. The hardware itself is they're kind of thinking it's on its last legs a bit. So, and one of the processes actually running is fairly business critical. I won't go into too many details. My task has been to get off that old software, and implement some new software, some stuff in AWS. So I've been using the transfer family there, which is, a way of creating SFTP service. SFTP is actually used quite a lot around in various places to move data from one place to another, or from a third party into your infrastructure. So, a bit of that. SQL Server as well. So it's actually the first time I've used Microsoft SQL Server, really. So, there's SQL Server running on that box that I mentioned, and it's about migrating those databases into a managed Azure managed instance for SQL. So we'll go there. Interesting stuff, and it's interesting to see what people implemented about 10, 15 years ago, and how you kind of modernize that and make it look the same to the third parties that are using it, really.
Have you been using any of the cloud native tools for getting the data across? Because I can't remember AWS's one, but there's sort of like a database migration one. I can't remember the name, but I've used it before to get on-prem SQL into basically replicating across to something else. But I just can't remember the name of it off the top of my head.
G- getting stuff into Azure, there's, I think you can do that with, now let me get this right, SSMS, SQL Server Management Studio. You can connect to the Azure database. You create the Azure database separately, or the instance, through however you'd like to do it, through Terraform or whatever. And then you can connect to it in SSMS, and you can connect to your on-prem, and then you can just say, migrate this one to this one, and it pretty much does it in the background. So yeah, in that kind of Microsoft way, it has that naming, that sort of generic naming, sort of does it for you. And sometimes it fails, and you don't really know why it failed.
To be fair, the AWS one, when I used it, was also a bit similar on that one. It was nice when it worked, but you couldn't always tell for a while. So yeah, definitely know that one.
I think, is it database migration tool or something like that in AWS?
Yeah, it's something like that. And yeah, it's interesting because it's not just I would go SQL to SQL, like, you know, I've done some stuff before with that where it's taking SQL but transforming it to put it into DynamoDB, and yet doing it kind of half natively and things like that. And it's, quite interesting when you do things on a bit more of a take the data and just turn it into something completely different, but not really have to think about it again, just set it and let it go. It's quite fun at that point. So, yeah.
Yeah. I think when you have data, like, you know, you have a load of data and you've got to get it somewhere else, sometimes those tools are the only way of doing it, really.
Yeah.
You just got to trust them and let them do it. And
yeah.
Obviously check it afterwards, sanity check it, but yeah.
Interesting. So you're going to Azure with it, like they're using their on the SQL Server in Azure, basically. Is that what you're doing with it, Jerry?
Yeah, so moving the data in that database to an Azure SQL managed instance. Sort of pre-existing one, yeah.
Cool. And are you doing one big backup in one big go? Are you going to do like incremental backups with it to get transfer the data? Or are we going to say like a hard stop and then export it and then import it again? Or
I mean, as I was saying, it's just that the tool is just doing it in the background somehow. We don't really know how. So I assume it's just, I don't know, maybe it's...
doing transaction logs, I'm guessing. So it's doing a transaction log. Cool. Interesting. I was talking that I've been doing quite some Linux-y stuff on having Linux. Windows 10 going out of support and trying to get people using new laptops, well, laptops which can support it. Obviously, like Windows 10 doesn't support, we're out of date or we're out of support last month, and that Windows 11 is coming along. But obviously, you have to have the hardware, the TPM in it to work. But like my wife's laptop is like a nice, it's like a T47 ThinkPad, and it runs, it's got like 16 gig of RAM, it's got a massive battery, it lasts forever. So I've been using Linux Mint on it. But I'm trying to do some pre-configuration on it and like what I need to do to back up the configs on it. So I was asking in our Telegram group what people use for kind of configuring the machines. So I've been I've been getting back into Ansible. I've been mainly using Puppet lately to configure stuff. But Ansible, I'm getting back into that. We're using Stuart script, what he had kind of thing. So I managed to get like all the app stuff installed using the app keys and getting then the app URLs and then just installing applications using apt and then using Flatpak to install some other stuff. Yes, it's got interesting. I didn't realize that you could do, I think it's like, is it --, connection like local or something like that, right, Stuart? That basically just didn't you, because like with Ansible, you can use it to normally just like over SSH, doesn't it, to configure. But if you do, that's quite interesting way of configuring stuff. So yeah, I was just wondering how you guys kind of like, it's quite good how I can set up a machine now from scratch really easy, just run it, download the YAML file and it goes away and configures it. Or
yeah, I mean John obviously is not here to mention it, but he's mentioned in the past that that's how he sets up a new laptop if he starts a new job. He has a set of playbooks to set up his laptop, his new laptop. or if you swap laptops or whatever.
Yeah, it's, I mean, yeah, as Al was saying, yeah, it's, I sent in my way of doing it, and it is just, you know, over-engineered Ansible for, you know, what, you know, there's a lot in there. It's kind of like, you know, it's trying to take Macs into account. I mean, you should have seen some of the earlier ones. It was trying to take in every distro I'd ever used at that point. It wasn't just the Debian-based stuff. It was trying to also do anything RHEL-based, Arch-based, not Nixos or anything like that. I've never got to Nix at any point. So maybe one day, I don't know.
I think famously you would have said if you had. Famously,
yeah, exactly. yeah. And by the way, I use Nix now rather than Arch. But yeah, it's... But yeah, I kind of, there's loads of different solutions for it. Like there's one called Chamois. There's loads of others that are just kind of mostly for dot files and that kind of management. But I was kind of, I want my installs taken care of. I want my, I mean, as I've probably espoused to many people, I'm very much a Vim diehard. So I need all of that configuring. VS Code just doesn't work for me. So I need all of that, you know, horrendously over engineered Vim config sorting as well. And it's all these kind of things that just means that go onto a new machine, it's there, it's ready, and I can just use it like any other machine at that point. But yeah, there are times where I go back and just go, if someone told me to do this again, would I? And the answer is probably not, but at least I've done it now, so I don't have to think about it anymore. But yeah, I'm sure, you know, I'm sure if I went on to something like Linux Matters or something, they'd just say, yeah, that Nix could do this in one config file, but just yeah, that's not for me right now. Maybe one day.
It's interesting because I'm, as I say, I'm being a contractor, quite often you are actually, for sort of tax reasons, you're supposed to use your own equipment where you can, but often companies, security, I would have thought mainly, will supply you with a laptop. So I'm actually in this position a fair amount of having to set something up from scratch. So I really should sort something out. But I think as long as I've got, as long as I set up an SSH key, and actually a GPG key is quite important because I use pass to store secrets, then I think I'm good to go. And I just install stuff as I need it. And it's generally, Some of it's curl, pipe through bash, and so on. But
the only way to really install something.
Yeah, but there's a few things like, I mean, I should write it down. Like there's, I think it's SSH keychain for SSH agent on WSL.
Yeah.
And yeah, like I say, GPG and setting up an SSH key, and then you're kind of, you've got that. That's a kind of bare minimum because then at least you can get pull. And talking about Vim, I used to use Vim, you know, in a terminal, but I switched to VS Code and I use Vim key bindings. So that muscle memory is still kind of used, but I have a GUI editor, yeah, which does help. But there is a little bit of confusion with yanking, you know, Y for yank, and then you've also got the normal clipboard for the system you're on. So that can get a bit confusing.
Yeah, it's part of the reason every time I've tried to use VS Code, I've just gone, well, I still try and use it like Vim. So I do have the Vim bindings on there, and I just go, something always gets me. I just go, that doesn't quite work the way I'm expecting. And when I hit it too much, I just go, no, I'm back out again, I'm back to Vim. So yeah.
Also, I think some of the key bindings conflict with the keyboard shortcuts of VS Code as well.
I like it for opening stuff and viewing it, but every time I have to edit, it's just, no, I'm back to my happy place. So, yeah. To be honest, I think most of the reason behind me managing my .dot files and config and installs through Ansible was probably Vim that started it, because I thought, right, well, I need to solve that. I need to solve my ZSH config so it looks nice on a terminal. I just thought, well, while I'm here, I may as well do the rest. Yeah. And then, yeah, that's just how it began. And, yeah, as I say, there's far too many commits now. It's probably my most committed project of all time, and it's just, yeah, probably shouldn't be, but, yeah, hey, so be it.
The other thing is mentioning ZSH is OhMyZSH. I don't know if you guys have used that or use that. Basically a framework for ZSH or Z-shell, Z-shell, whatever you want to call it. And it has various plugins that people have written. One of them is a Git plugin, which has a load of aliases, I've seen, you know, they're kind of standard. So Git pull, Git add, minus U, git fetch, all those, git stash, that's another one. They're aliases, so sort of two to four letters, which you type to do all these things, which speeds up if you're on the command line. And because it's a standard thing, it's, you know, everyone can use the same aliases basically. So that's quite good. And the other one is fuzzy find, for the control R, the text search, yeah, backwards text search. And that gives you like a list of, so you type in, do control R, type in as a string for what you want to, a string from a command that you type in your history. And then it will give you like a half your terminal of options of what it might be. And then you can just tab up and down to the one you want. It's quite nice.
Yeah, I've been using OMIZSH for quite a while as well. And one of them I like for that one is similar, except when you type it on the command line itself and you just press up, it'll go to most recent commands that looked like that. So if you type in something like, I don't know, kubectl or something, it only brings up the kubectl commands if you press up or whatever, and the closer you get to it, brings them up. And yeah, I just like stuff like that. But I think the weird thing for me that made me kind of get into OMIZSH and just ZSH in general was coming from a network background. And every time I was on a Cisco, when I wanted to know what the next command would either be, press a tab or do the question mark on it, and it'd tell me, right, what's the next bit of this command? And because Bash is kind of, not everything has a completion, well, OMIZSH came with half the plugins, so it's kind of right, well, this feels a bit more natural to me, so it's the way I've tended to go with it, of just right, because it's got so many different things, completion built in. Yes, I know Bash has it, but not everything does it natively, whereas because of OMIZSH has so much of it built in, it's kind of, it's there under my fingers, so I just, I think from there I just went, oh, I like this, and then again, never really left. I tried Fish for a bit, and the problem I had with Fish is it's great until you try and do any Bash one-liners, and then half of it doesn't work anymore. So I just went, right, I'm going back to ZSH again, because that, there's only a couple of bits that I find problems with. All my other Bash one-liners just work for that problem. So
it's close enough to Bash that you don't fall over when you try and do something.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's also worth mentioning that ZSH is the default on a Mac, which is why I think OMIZSH was written, because a lot of people who do what we do use Macs.
Yes.
So it's like most of those tools, like a lot of tools that you use will be in Homebrew, the kind of third party package manager for the Mac. So even on a Linux system in the past, or WSL, I've installed something called Linux Brew to get some tools on the command line, which goes to the Homebrew repos, I believe, and downloads your stuff for you.
Yeah, I've never actually tried the non-Mac OS version of it, but yeah, I probably should make all my .dot files much easier, because I just use one package manager rather than 20 different ones like I was at one point. I mean, yeah, it's just two now, because I only do Debian-based stuff now anyway,
I did think, I'm on Linux, I've got a package manager, why should I use another package manager? And isn't that going to lead to confusion? But which kind of does, if you're not careful.
I mean, to be fair, if you're using pip and you're using, all the Go stuff and then Cargo and everything, next thing you know, you're using a different package manager for every tool anyway. So
Yeah, that's true.
Obviously NPM and, installing stuff to put a space in your code or whatever, but anyway.
Yeah. I mean, talking about that, I've used both Go and NPM in the past couple of weeks, coding up something for this role I'm working in. So basically, I hate using the term, but vibe coded something in Go to replace a dodgy PowerShell script. I should emphasize that I do try and learn a bit along the way. So I learned a bit of Go when I did that, rather than just pushing the code and with no other thought. So yeah, learned a bit, and NPM, there's a There's something called SST, which we'll put a link in the show notes for that. I think it's a subset of Pulumi, so it's using TypeScript. And it gives you like a very opinionated way of creating AWS resources. So it's literally a couple of lines to create an S3 bucket, for instance, and it will do. So with S3, each bucket name is unique because it's a host name, like a public host name. So each bucket name needs to be unique, and it will create the buckets with the string that you provide plus a random string. So that's what I mean by opinionated. It will do that so that you don't get a naming conflict with another bucket that someone else has created. So it's just a useful way, and it's gives developers an easy way to create infrastructure, basically. Yeah, so SST stands for serverless stack, we've got a link in the show notes to that. I haven't really explored it, so I don't want to talk too much about it. And I haven't done much JavaScript or TypeScript ever before, other than installing some tools that I use. So yeah, a bit more learning to do there before I talk about it.
So I was going to actually ask, how have you found, as you say, you vibe coded a bit, understand it a bit more. Have you found Golang to read and actually deal with? I've done a fair amount with Go, so yeah, I'm pretty familiar with it. I was wondering how you're finding it.
I found reading it, I don't find it particularly readable at the moment. Maybe I haven't had enough exposure to it. Also, the fact it's compiled language rather than you just type the code and then you can't just type the code and run it. There's another step of compiling it, which you have to remember to do. In this case, LLM was doing it. So
yeah.
Once I found the right button, I've been using Open Code and Claude Code, and there's a switch on there where it will make the commits or it will change the code itself, or it will tell you there's another mode where it will tell you what changes to make. First, if you want something done quickly, you do the former where it just does it, but you don't really learn anything. And in the other mode, it actually tells you the changes, tells you why the changes are being made, and it's up to you to implement it. So you get to learn a bit more. So that's just following on a bit from the discussion in the last episode about use of AI. The thing that I was trying to do worked, but that, because I coaxed the LLM into writing the right code, probably no other reason than that.
No, makes sense. I suppose that does kind of lead on to something else we're going to talk about, which is kind of the whole platform and DevOps and SRE and, you know, all the difference with it. Because, yeah, I suppose potentially, you know, if we're talking 15, 20 years ago, would someone be coding up in Golang or something like, I mean, yeah, Go didn't exist at the time, but yeah, would someone be doing the coding and would be asking someone else to do it? And it's kind of, yeah, I suppose what kind of things have you seen in terms of the jobs that are referred to as these? Do you see any differences between the terms that we've got? So let's call them out. There's platform engineering, DevOps, sysadmins, and SREs are probably the most popular ones. There's probably others out there, cloud engineers and stuff like that, but it's a bit more specific. What kind of differences have people seen in them? And, you know, has anyone got any good definitions for them?
I'd say sysadmin definitely means, Linux or Windows engineer. That's how I'd probably define it more descriptive way. Someone that has been using those systems for a long time and knows how to configure them, knows how they can go wrong, and maybe less of a programmer. I'm talking about myself here, really. less of a development background and just, a sort of deep knowledge of those operating systems more than anything else. Yeah, as for the others, so SRE, for instance, I think that's probably your work.
So for me, an SRE, I mean, I think the problem is these terms, because they can be used interchangeably, because some places will just go, oh right, platform engineering. That's what people want now. We'll call people platform engineers, but the job still hasn't changed from the last three iterations of the job title change. But SRE is supposed to mean in terms of one, I suppose, define what it actually means. SRE is site reliability engineering, and that's kind of the point. It's to increase reliability, but to a point of what's acceptable for the business. So you can't make something 100% reliable because that's financially impossible. What you're trying to do is make it as good as it can be to meet the expectations of the customers. And one analogy that comes up quite a lot of work is if someone goes to YouTube and something starts buffering, people don't immediately just go, well, I'm never going to use YouTube again. They'll wait a few seconds and then the video starts, they'll carry on as normal. Whereas if every time you went there, it buffered and never loaded anything, you'd never use YouTube. So the point there is everyone's got a tolerance for reliability. And by the same extent, everyone's got a tolerance for how unreliable something can be before they'll not use it anymore. And effectively, SRE is kind of trying to find what that point is and engineer systems so that they can be reliable enough to meet that and not really any more than that. Because, yeah, one, it saves costs. Two, it saves engineering time. And three, you don't need something more reliable than anyone's ever going to expect it. If effectively when you're talking from what you're actually doing, a lot of it is getting monitoring in place, but less about just, you know, what's the CPU you're using, what's the memory you're using. You're more going, right, if a user's trying to use this, what is their experience? And that's what you're trying to reflect with it and make your system match well. Are we meeting the experience of what people are expecting? So that's where your monitoring comes from. But a lot of it's also about reducing toil. So if you're doing stuff day to day all the time, rather than doing it manually, it would be, you know, first time you do it manually, second time you automate it, third time, well, there shouldn't be a third time. So it's all about just automating as much as you can. But again, it's also striking the balance between if I spend 2-3 weeks working on this thing to automate it for a task that I do an hour once a year, maybe that's not a problem. Now, if that hour once a year is certificate expiry and you forget it every year, maybe it is worth doing that. But ignoring stuff like that, generally, if it's just a task that all you need to do is stick a calendar invite once a year and go do it, maybe spending, you know, a month of engineering time or whatever on that isn't the best use of time. But again, it's about reducing toil.
You mentioned toil. What does toil mean if someone doesn't know what that means?
Yeah, so toil effectively means work that could be automated, work that doesn't need to be done by a human, realistically. So, but it work that is currently being done by a human. So you're just trying to reduce that. So, yeah. But again, a lot of it is about, you know, making things more reliable, but it's also making it so that people themselves are more reliable in a sense as well. Because if they're spending all this time, you know, doing manual tasks all the time, you sometimes miss the wood for the trees and you're not seeing the real problems because you're missing all the stuff that's easy is gone. It's gone to the computers. The computers are doing the work on that. Right, let's focus on what the real problems are, the big problems and things like that. So, yeah. So toil in that sense is reducing tasks that are repeatable and could easily, they don't really need human interaction. They don't need a human opinion on what's this got to be like. Again, certificate expiry is a very good example of that. You just need something towards the end, just going, right, renew that. And yeah, that's where stuff like Let's Encrypt and things like that solves that. But which, again, reduced toil for a lot of the world at that point, never mind for certain businesses. But the point there is it meant that, you know, rather than someone going in and going, right, I'll go renew this, and then a year later, I'll go renew this or whatever, reducing that toil means, right, okay, well, that's now done by the computers. It's not something we have to care about anymore.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Long-winded way of saying SRE is trying to make systems more reliable, but to not to the point to make it financially unachievable. It's just to make it so that your systems are better and systems perform as good as the users expect and no more than that. Because as long as you're meeting user expectations, do you really need to make it any better than that? Probably not. So that's the SRE side. Has anyone got anything for platform and DevOps, or do we still want to talk about the SRE bit?
Just on the SRE stuff, I was showing the guys this book, O'Reilly Observability Engineering, which is written by some people from Honeycomb.
Yes.
Honeycomb.io, I believe. And there's an interesting thing now. I'll read from it right now if I've got it right here. If the 140-second slowest user complained about performance speed, can you isolate their requests to understand why exactly things are slow for that specific user? So I guess that's having the tools to be able to dig down into the massive. So you've got the monitoring in place, but you need to actually be able to dig down into it to find out and pinpoint exactly why someone is complaining about something, or if, you know, 1,000 users are complaining about something. You know, that side of things. I've mentioned this to a client this week. At the moment, I'm just monitoring the system level stuff like CPU, disk, RAM usage. And there happened to be some issues last week. They've got their product is, got more usage in this couple of weeks. And so they're saying, why is all this CPU usage? And I said to them, well, having these metrics, it's like having a pain in your foot and not knowing what caused the pain in your foot. And then later on, you find out it's because you've got a broken toe. You know, that's, it's actually a real life example that happened to me in a couple of months ago. So it's like being able to reach down into the data that you have to work out why. And if you can do that through tooling or data that you're collecting about your systems, then that's quite a useful thing.
Yeah. It's something they call the pillars of observability. One of them's metrics, one of them's logs, and one of them's tracing, which, to be fair, some people are also talking about a fourth one sometimes, but yeah, it depends on the company. Some don't. That's the profiling. But yeah, most people talk about logs, traces, and metrics. And the way to look at them is kind of metrics tell you what a system is doing right now in numbers. Logs will tell you. So the numbers are easy to aggregate, easy to show in a dashboard, and just easy to alert on. Logs themselves, you can dig down into it and just say, right, well, the application is telling me this is what's happening. But that's only what someone's written and decided to log out. Now, at that point, if someone's not decided to log something, it won't be in your logs. So, yeah, it depends on who's written it.
It's literally a line in the code which says log this to the log.
Exactly. Which, you know, if an application's well built, well logged, then you will get most of what you need out of there anyway. But that's not easy to alert on unless you're looking at, you know, specific patterns. So a lot of the time you might take your logs and generate metrics based upon counts of logs and things like that. So again, that goes back to metrics again. But yeah, tracing and things like, I mean, as you mentioned, the observability engineering comes from Honeycomb, and they do a lot with tracing in terms of OpenTelemetry and their own agents. But yeah, OpenTelemetry has become massive over the past couple of years.
But that means, like, you with the tracing, you can trace a user session from like clicking on one thing, and then it goes through different applications. You can then see them. And then with your line you were saying a minute ago, Jerry, that you can. And then a lot of things you can talk about is the SLIs and SLOs as well, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
So which is service level, what's I stand for?
Service level indicators and then SLOs, objectives. So yeah, so I'll go a bit into the telemetry bit first. So that's the that's the bit of, you'll go, right, okay, as you say, you take a user session and put it through. What that's doing in the background is there's something called a span. And that span contains information about what is happening in the code at that point. So it's not just at what a user decided to log out. A lot of the time, especially in OpenTelemetry, they'll do what's called auto-instrumentation. So it will know what a certain library looks like. So saying Go, there's a few, can't remember the exact ones, but there's, I think Gorm's like an SQL library in there, and then there's a few web ones as well for APIs. It will know what that looks like, so it knows the kind of data you should put out. And what it'll do is, right, it'll send that, when it sends a request, just sort of like a HTTP request, there'll be a couple of headers in there, and one of them will say parent span ID. you get to the next application that receives the request in, but that request, because it's got this HTTP header that says parent span, it goes, right, okay, well, when I create this data, well, my parent is this. And then when it sends that over to the application that's taken in this telemetry, it's just gone, right, well, this parent passed to this, and then this is now the parent of this one. So that's how it joins it across lots of applications. So rather than going, right, what did this do? What did this do? What did this do? It joins all of them together at that point. So it's how you end up in this position of, yeah, I can now literally see what my code is doing, see that it's going, oh, it's got to the SQL method in my application, it's tried to call out and it's taken 20 seconds to do that. That query should only take one. Why is it doing that? And you can see, rather than, well, I got here and my metrics are telling me something's broken, but I don't know what's down the stack. Well, stuff like OpenTelemetry and, yeah, there's other ones that do it. It's not just OpenTelemetry, but it's so big right now. It's becoming the standard anyway. So that's how all that works.
I'm actually using that to collect host metrics. So that's the system level metrics I was talking about. They're using OpenTelemetry to collect those at the moment. So I need to get the developers to create some application logs so that I can get some more useful stuff out.
Yeah, it's interesting as well, because you can take it's something called exemplars. I think this might be the Prometheus only term, but I think it's used in others. And what they have is kind of like, if you have this exemplar, if you've got that instrumented in your login and instrumented in your tracing, you can click on your metrics and it will go straight into, right, what was the log that corresponds to this?
Oh,
what's
nice.
The trace that corresponds to this? So you can just say, oh, well, I've seen HTTP 500s increase. Why? Oh, there's this little spike there. I'll press there, jumps in, and then you can start to see it all together. Now, that means that, yes, stuff like, let's call some out, Datadog would have all that already because it controls all of that system, whereas Prometheus, because it's separate from OpenTelemetry, you need these things to bring them together. But something like Datadog, something like Honeycomb, gathers that already, so it's already pulling them, but it's also possible to do it without paying lots of money for some of the bigger platforms for it, not to disparage any of them, because they are great at what they do, but also, yeah, you need the budget of a small country sometimes to pay for them. So, there is that.
Horror stories about Datadog. Throwing any shade on Datadog, but people have received bills for hundreds of thousands of dollars because they basically they're logging too much data to Datadog, and Datadog are happy to store it from and also happy to charge them for it. So.
Yeah, I'll just say, if you turn indexing on, then you can basically turn any money off at that point. That's a problem I've found in the past with Datadog. But to go to the SLIs and the SLOs thing, that becomes a bit of an extension of that. So you've got all your monitoring, you've got your data. So whether that's through metrics, through logs, through traces, as I say, logs to get them into a point that you can use them for SLIs and SLOs, as I'll get into in a second, you tend to need to turn them into metrics like count of how many logs have done this, count of that. SLI or service level indicator, that is a data source. So that could be, how many HTTP 200s do I get compared to how many HTTP requests there are? That's a SLI at that point. Or how many times has this logged this specific message in the past hour, kind of thing. That's an SLI. So it's basically, it's not the what you expect out of it. It's literally just the data itself. So it's just SLI is what data you're getting. And then the objective takes that and just goes, right, what should I expect out of this one? So let's say 99.5% of my HTTP requests should not error, at which point you're saying that, right, as long as I'm hitting that, I meet my user expectations. But the point there, and it's going back to what I was saying before about an expectation from reliability. Well, if you're expecting that 99.5% of your HTTP requests should be good, or 0.5% of your requests can be bad and still meet user expectations. So you can still fail 0.5% of the time and still meet user expectations. And this kind of leads back into something called an error budget. And what you can say with that error budget is, like I'm saying, the 0.5% of the time that you can return bad requests, or not even saying bad, but just, yeah, like I say, you know, 500 error codes or something, if you're allowing that because that meets user expectation, that means 5.5% of the time that you're doing stuff, you could take the service down, you can do upgrades to it, you can try out new features on that application and still meet user expectations, because they expect that 99.5% of the time it's up, or 0.5% of the time it can be down. So, and that's what this budget comes in of, I have 0.5% of a given time to do something with it. And that sometimes can lead to things like chaos engineering of just, if I took stuff down, what would happen? It can also lead into, right, we've got a new feature we're not sure on, roll it out, and if it breaks, I've got to roll it back, we're still in user expectations. So, yeah, so that's where it comes down to, realistically. The SRE side, especially when it comes to SLIs and SLOs, is, again, trying to judge how much unreliability users can take before it becomes a problem, at which point using that time effectively to make your systems better. So you can, as I say, take a system down, upgrade it, replace it, try a new thing, try a new feature. But it also tells you that, if you're not meeting that, well, no new features can go out because we're not meeting our user expectations. Right, put a block on that, work only on reliability work. And that's where this comes in. It gives you an actual measure, basically a database measure of, are we meeting user expectations? Yes or no? If we're not, then we can't be doing new features because we're already annoying users as it is. Stop that, make it more reliable. Or we're not, we are meeting them. Do what we want for a bit.
I've just looked up these 99.5%. So that equates to 7 minutes a day, 50 minutes a week, 3 hours 40 a month.
Yeah.
Nearly 11 hours a quarter, or 1 hour, 1 day, 20 hours a year. So just to give listeners some idea of how long that actually allows.
Yeah. So
for that 99.5% figure.
Yeah. So basically what that means is that if your service was down for a full day, you're still meeting user expectations. Yes, it's not the nicest of experiences if it was down for a full day, but technically you've met it. But the point isn't that you just go, right, take the service down for a day and leave it. It's, again, it's back to the, if I try something out and it doesn't work, I've still got the reliability aspect I've still got the error budget to say, I'm allowed to do this because we've agreed with our clients, our users, whatever, to say we will meet this, but we will not. If we meet better than that, great, but that's our expectation. If we meet that and that alone, we've still met your expectations. So, yeah, it just gives you this almost like a bit of wiggle room to just go, I want to try something out. It's a bit risky. Let's try it. Mm-hmm. Did that work? Oh, no, right. Roll back. It's fine. Or actually it worked. Leave it there. And it just gives that database metric to effectively turn around to product managers and, project managers to say, yes, you're trying to roll out these new features. This is the window that we've got. If it doesn't work in that, we don't get that till the next month. Or, actually we're not meeting user expectations. Stop. We can't do new features. Doesn't matter how much customers are shouting, because also we've got other customers shouting to say it's not working. So yeah, probably need to prioritize them so we keep them, rather than, rolling out, add a new green button or something like that to this when we're not even able to show the buttons in the first place.
But you normally, with the SLOs, you don't normally publish them to your customer. You normally have the SLAs you publish to your customer.
Yeah.
And SLOs are kind of like an internal thing, right?
Yeah, quite often you'll do SLAs as a... So the difference between SLO and SLA, so SLO said service level objective, SLA is service level agreement. The difference between them is SLAs, as you say, are what you agree with your customers. Sometimes you might publish your SLOs as well, depending on how well you know your customers. Sometimes your customers, you've got the whole what you'd call an internal customer as well. So actually, they may have access to the same systems and be doing their own SLOs so they can see yours. Quite often what you'll do is you'll go, right, okay, well, I've got an SLA. I can meet that. I've got an SLA, I can't make that stricter than my SLOs. So if my SLOs are, you know, 99.5% of the time I'm returning, you know, good responses, but my SLA says 99.9% of the time. Well, at that point, the objective that you're trying to hit is worse than what you've agreed, at which point you can never, you break one without breaking the other, and it just, the incentives are wrong. But on the other way around, if you said, right, 99.5% of the time we will meet this internally, but you give to users 99% of the time we'll hit this, then you've always got that little bit of, even if we went outside of it, yes, we've got some work to do to make this service more reliable, but we've still got a little bit to go before actually the customers themselves are properly annoyed by it. Yes, they might still not like the fact that the service is down 1% of the time, but again, it's all about the agreements up front kind of thing. And yeah, as I say, because you've got the whole internal and external customers thing, sometimes you might just agree the SLO is the SLO at that point because you're all working towards the same goal and the same platform in the end anyway. But yeah, so that's how that tends to work. But yeah, there's nothing to say you can't make your SLA identical to your SLO. But if you can get a customer to agree to an SLA that's not quite as strict as your SLO, it does make things a bit easier.
So in terms of internal customers, you might be, so if you're working in like an environment with microservices, for instance, you might have SLAs between teams, effectively.
Yeah, exactly. It was a big thing where I work right now. It's one of the first things we did is, right, this part of the product other people use and their expectations is it's up 100% of the time. Well, that's functionally impossible because they're on systems which can't be up 100% of the time, so there must be something here. Yeah, one of the big things we did is go around to teams and say, what are your expectations? And don't say 100% because it just can't be done. And they just say, oh, right, well, okay. It'd be nice if it was up 99.5% of the time and 99.9% or whatever. And then we turn around and say, right, in the event that this fails, what can you do to your system to make this handle this? So rather than just failing entirely, they could return a partial response. So say it's, I don't know, a web page or something, and it's got a news section and an ad section and a, you know, see more section. Well, if we can't get to the bit that does the news, then just return and just do the other stuff, but just say the news isn't there today or the news isn't there at this point, rather than just saying the website's broken, that kind of thing. So encouraging people to just go expect unreliability and build for that. And then at that point, if it does go down, yeah, you can still do something rather than just making the experience functionally awful for the customer at that point. Make it at least passable. And then at that point, you'll get less complaints as well because they can at least do something, even if it's not everything they want to do at the time.
Yeah, because interesting, like you said about like on the thing on the hybrid cloud show, we put a link in the show notes to that with our friend Gary on. Yeah, they were saying like you can't have it 100% time because you just have to throw, you say, you can't just throw hundreds, millions and millions of pounds to it kind of thing to be up all the time.
Yeah, it's the whole thing about, you know, build redundant systems as best as you can, but to meet your goal. And if that goal again is, well, the users actually, I suppose take it as, you know, they're going to come to us anyway because it might be one of the only places to get this stuff, or, you know, our competitors actually, they have a worse SLO than us or a worse published SLA. So maybe we don't need to be as strict as that. As long as we're up more than them, then actually we're still doing good. So maybe we shouldn't build around being up 100% of the time, just make it reliable enough that it handles most cases. So it turns you from going, right, okay, well, I need everything to be multi-region, multi-cloud, and, you know, fail over to here and fail over to that. You just go, right, okay, what's the easiest thing that we can recover from in the specified amount of time that we've got to work in? And if you can, yeah, you can make a system so complex that it should be 100% reliable, but then if it goes down, no one can do anything with it. Or you can make it as simple as possible. And yes, technically less reliable if you're doing a DR plan or something like that. But if someone tries to go in and understand it, it's just, right, okay, well, I just flip a switch and it does this. Right, okay, done at that point. So sometimes it's as much about giving your engineers a better time as it is your customers too.
It ties into the cloud outages we were talking about earlier as well, which you probably alluded to there, Al, is sometimes the clouds themselves are unreliable, so you have to plan for that as well.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Don't think you're going to get 100% uptime.
Yeah. Yeah. There's always a financial limit somewhere. And yeah, sometimes you find that before you're reliable enough. Sometimes you're reliable enough and yeah, you've got enough money for it. So yeah.
So that kind of covers SRE. Problem is, I think we've kind of run out of time for this episode. So maybe we should turn this into a bit of a series and have a little on-air production.
I think it's as well what different companies define it as different things, don't they, really? Everyone, it's all the same thing under the hood. Everyone just like, if you apply for jobs, it's like, anyone, it's like knowing what DevOps, isn't it, kind of thing. And then like sysadmin kind of thing, because it's like, yeah, what the company thinks they think they need you to do, kind of thing, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Also, I worked somewhere where SRE didn't stand for site reliability engineer. It stood for, I think it was system reliability engineer.
Yeah.
But it was not what I was expecting. So, and I was in the SRE team, and I wasn't thinking about SLIs and SLAs and stuff day to day.
Interestingly,
sure.
the term has kind of been half adopted for networking. There's a lot of NRE or network resiliency engineering. So it's basically applying that same approach, but literally to the networking stuff, not systems, which it's kind of not quite right, for the sense that site reliability engineering isn't about your systems. It's about the platform, effectively, at that point. It's making your site reliable, but that would include the network. So I suppose, in a sense, it's kind of, it's just so you can have the word network in there, I guess, at that point, so it tells you the kind of job that it is. But yeah, every time I see that term, I just go, that's not quite what that means. But I don't want to get into a big long discussion arguing with people, so I just go, you know what, leave it. I know what it means, I'll just walk off from it.
I think these terms evolve over time as well. It's like a few years ago, maybe 10 years ago, everyone was a DevOps engineer, even though, as we've discussed in previous episodes, DevOps engineer isn't really, according to the original definition, shouldn't really be a term that you can actually use.
No.
So, but I think that's evolved over time, that DevOps engineer term has come to mean something else, which maybe we'll discuss in a future episode.
And like, it's all like the high words, isn't it? Now my place is all FinOps, about the financial stuff and like how we build stuff through, and that's quite, maybe we could maybe do some research on that and then talk about that on a future episode as well.
That's more like cost management, isn't it, FinOps? Like, stop your cloud bill being too high, kind of thing.
Yeah, it turns out if you put ops onto the end of anything, you can make a job title for anything. So, yeah.
Okay, I think we'll just end it there. John couldn't make it this week. We didn't mention it at the start. He had prior arrangements. So you can find all our contact details on www.adminpodcast.co.uk, which has got our email address on and our Telegram thing. Hopefully you should be a bit more active now that when we release, we've got our first episode 102 to go released. We're just doing the show notes for that. So hopefully once you hear this, we'll definitely be 102 will be out, and we'll be,
a little peek behind the curtain there.
Yeah.
It'll definitely be out by the time this one's out, I hope.
No, let's do it out of order, really confuse everyone.
Okay, so
I should mention our ways to get in touch with us. You can email, if you still do that, to mail at admin@adminpodcast.co.uk, and we've got a Telegram group, and we have a link for that in the show notes and on the website at admin@adminpodcast.co.uk. If you've got any questions you want us to answer, contact us by email or in our Telegram group, as I mentioned. And we'll try to answer it in a future show.
Cool. So, I've been Al.
I've been Stu.
And I've been Jerry.
And I hope we haven't saw that for another show, have we? <Can't> be. Cool. See you all next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Now it's over. I can open any door. Now it's over. I don't need you anymore. Now it's over. Open any door. Now it's over. I never needed you before.
You've been listening to a member of the Other Side Podcast Network. Find more about our shows at othersidenetwork.com.